Hello and welcome to 42 Talks, the podcast which takes a deep dive into the legal world, led by the experienced members of 42 BR Barristers. I'm Stephanie Mendoris, a member of the family team at 42 BR, and I'm delighted to be joined by Tina Cook Casey to discuss and consider the dynamic changes in adoption, the importance of post-adoption contact, and how, as practitioners, we can better meet the needs of adopted children.
And I am Tina Cook, and I practice in public and private or childcare, as Stephanie does. You may already be aware of Baker LJ's recent helpful romp, through the authorities on post-adoption contact, following McFarlane, the President's, two lectures on the changing landscape in respect of post-adoption contact in R&C, Adoption or Fostering 2024.
Well, hot on the heels of this and hot off the press, on the 7th of November, the Public Law Working Group produced a final report on contact in adoption, which contains guidelines for how to address these issues in local authority final evidence and the Guardian's final analysis prior to making of a placement order. We're going to discuss some of each of those with you. We'll focus on adoption and contact, which is found at Chapter 1 of the report.
Before we do that, I have an interest, not a conflict of interest, I don't think, to disclose to you, because until 12 months ago, I was a trustee of a voluntary adoption agency, a charity, whose aim was to find families for the most difficult to place children, sibling groups and those who've been abused. So now you know that that might impact on some of my views. The adoption process has undergone considerable change in the last 5 years. The advice in the documents we're discussing is long overdue.
The Public Law Working Group was established by the President of the Family Division of England and Wales, Sir Andrew McFarlane. The adoption subgroup, chaired by Mrs. Justice Judd, and with a membership of professionals from across the adoption sector, has been working on the review, consultation and report for 4 years. It focuses on five areas: international adoption, consensual adoption, access to adoption records, processes and procedures in court, and contact. The report is extremely detailed and provides dozens of recommendations across the five areas. It's intended as a review of the adoption process and a catalyst for positive changes, and also a useful tool for those working in adoption and related services. The report finds that the model of adoption has adapted and changed over the years, and that more needs to be done to make it effective now, including making use of digital tools for both training, information, and contact. The original model for adoption was of children who were born illegitimate or to impoverished or young parents and being relinquished at birth to be placed with more financially and socially secure childless married couples. Children placed under this arrangement were usually very young and had no attachment or memory of their birth family. The stigma attached to illegitimacy and infertility meant that the decision not to promote contact was considered to be a protective factor for the adopter, the adopted child, and the birth family. There was little call then for post-adoption contact. Now, however, most children are adopted from care, although there remains a small number of cases where babies are relinquished for adoption. The headlines of the report are that the court should be making contact orders to lay down a pattern for post-adoption contact that is in the child's best interests following the making of a placement order, which is what R&C says. So ongoing parental contact prior to adoption is more likely to continue where the welfare arguments support it. And the court should also be looking, perhaps harder, or in some cases for the first time, at the pros and cons of post-adoption contact as part of the re-BS balancing exercise, and perhaps casting the net further in terms of what family members it considers the question of post-adoption contact with in order to foster a sense of identity for the child.
We were struck by paragraph 8 of the report. And I quote from that: "The importance of identity to each human being is much better understood than it once was." That's a huge understatement, but a good starting point. It's our experience, and mine involved in an adoption agency as a trustee. It was always so obvious that the stability of the adoptive placements were being jeopardised by the lack of application of the research, as evidenced by the manner in which the court deals with adoption. These are hugely important topics. For example, the importance of attachment between a birth parent, a sibling, and a child separated from them, that child's understanding of its birth family and the reasons for separation, the adoptive family's understanding of the birth family, and the great need for education of social workers, adoption workers, lawyers and judges. It appears to us to be a fantastic attempt to implement that research, advice and experience to improve the chances of success of placements, and also to improve the lot of families whose child is adopted, the adopted child and the birth families. There are many strands which are a breath of fresh air and a common sense attempt to shore up the child themselves, upon the premise that unless the child can make sense of what has happened and can understand its links and backgrounds, the placement is less secure and more likely to fail. It seems to us that this triumvirate of information is the culmination of good old-fashioned attachment disorder theory and common sense, keeping lines of communication open between families, adoption workers and adoptive parents. The chronology in the last 18 months has been Andrew McFarlane's lectures, the first, the Mayflower lecture in November 23, the second, called the Potato lecture in May 2024, R&C, the judgment of which was handed down by the Court of Appeal on the 30th of October 2024, and then the Public Law Working Group Adoption Subcommittee, which we'll refer to as the report. That was published in November 2024, Mrs. Justice Judd being the chair of the Adoption Subcommittee. Starting with the last, the report. And there's really so much we'd like to take you to, but won't have time to. It really is worth a read, as are the lectures of Andrew McFarlane. The main recommendations of the report are that there needs to be a change in face-to-face contact between adopted children and birth families, with training and greater support and counselling for the birth families. Number two, there should be a national protocol for a standard procedure for access to records applications. Number three, in order to simplify the extremely complex systems of adoption with an international element, the statutory framework should be rewritten so it's contained in one single Act of Parliament. In the meantime, there's an urgent need for a written guidance. Number four, a national strategy for adoption by consent cases needs to be developed, including training for all, better access to legal advice for parents before birth, and that local authorities bring proceedings straight away and that they are listed urgently. The president of the Family Division, Andrew McFarlane, said of the report, "I welcome all the report's recommendations. The recommendations concerning contact with a child's birth family are especially important, but the particular arrangements in each case must be determined by the needs of the individual child."
Now turning to the report itself, Chapter 1, Adoption and Contact. The main recommendation is that there should be a tailor-made approach to the issue of contact for each adopted child, which includes and promotes face-to-face contact with important individual in that child's life, if it can be safely achieved and if it's in the child's best interest. The issue of contact needs to be actively considered throughout the child's minority, not only before the adoption order is made. The report grapples with the issue of how we can achieve the best outcomes for adoptive children and how contact plays such an important part in that outcome. And that is considered against three distinct stages of the adoption process. Number one, before an application for adoption, so the preparation stage. Number two, the court stage, during proceedings for placement and adoption. And finally, number three, post-adoption, so after court proceedings. The report takes an overview of research and lectures by the President from 2017 to 2024. The message from the President was that any move towards greater openness and flexibility in post-adoption contact must be on a case-by-case basis, in a manner that brings the adopters along consensually. And the message from those lectures was that the court and family judiciary have an important part to play in the cultural shift towards greater openness for adopted people and for their families. Orders for contact made at the time of placement order under Section 26 of the Adoption and Children Act 2002 can set the template for contact going forward, and this will be an important known about the child to be taken on board by any potential adopters with whom placement may be considered. And during the matching process, prospective adopters will take on board each aspect of the child's needs when deciding whether or not they feel able to offer them a home. The need for contact with a birth family ought not to be seen as a separate category from the other needs of the child, for example, those which relate to health or specific learning or cultural needs. It's therefore important that judges and magistrates give priority to the determination of contact arrangements when making a placement order.
At paragraph 62, the report emphasises the experience of practitioners in Northern Ireland, where post-adoption contact plans more often than not include direct contact with birth families. It has had an enormous impact on the recommendations of the group. The report at paragraph 65 also summarises issues that arise from recent research that has influenced the thinking of the group, and the research is described as pivotal. And there are about 10 points I'm just going to read out to you. The first is the transparency and openness around birth families is beneficial to the adopted child. The purpose of post-adoption contact is for the adoptee to understand experiences and develop a sense of identity. Three, separating siblings can lead to an enduring sense of loss. Four, there are strong indications that face-to-face contact helps adoptees develop a sense of identity, accept the reasons why they're adopted, and move forward with their lives. Five, ensuring that contact is safe for the child is pivotal to positive outcomes. Six, communications with and understanding from parties is an important component of success. Seven, despite the research indicating the benefits of face-to-face contact, where it can be safely managed, the majority of cases continue to be recommended only letterbox contact. Where direct contact does happen, it often happens without formal agreement. Eight, letterbox contact can prove problematic. A high number of arrangements stall. And number nine, the experience of Northern Ireland tends to suggest that a shift in mindset by professionals involved in the process and strong guidance from the judiciary can bring about a change in approach to face-to-face contact without the need for changes in primary legislation. The report queries how well professionals are trained. The research is disseminated. We know that they're not well trained, and we know that the research isn't disseminated. There's no minimum standard of national training for prospective adopters, and the availability of research to practitioners of all fields requires an element of private study and exploration that's not always possible. There are general recommendations between paragraphs 71 and 78, and here are just a few of them. There needs to be a sea change in the approach to the question of face-to-face contact between adopted children and the birth family or other significant individuals. The current system, whereby face-to-face contact is exceptional rather than the rule, is outdated. There should be consistent training for prospective adopters throughout England and Wales. The training needs to place at its core the lifelong adoption needs of the adopted people in relation to their sense of identity and loss in respect of their birth family connections, and the importance of open communication with the birth family. There should be an ongoing training for social work practitioners and lawyers to the benefits of open adoption, including training into the outcome of research into post-adoption contact. Birth parents should be signposted to independent support. Independent support is crucial to success. CAFCAS and IROs may have a role in ensuring accountability for the support. So support should be available via services offered by regional adoption agencies. And finally, in this section, consideration should be given to best practice. A helpful starting point, they say, is best practice guidance already published in Wales, dealing with the approach of practitioners to post-adoption contact.
Moving on to the recommendations for pre-proceedings, the report at paragraph 79 sets out those. There should be identification of those persons who are or may be important to the child. Should be undertaken at the family group conference and during any pre-proceedings kinship assessment stage, rather than just identifying potential alternative carers. When preparing the mandatory genogram for the SWET, there should be an eco map of important relationships. And important relationships are people that encompass within the family, or may not be in the family, significant to the subject child, and those individuals within the family who can provide information and news about significant family members, who can reassure the child that they are remembered or can facilitate a positive contact experience. It goes on to say that there should be specific guidance as to the prospective roles of child protection social workers and adoption social workers, including a clear expectation of when they will be liaising as early liaison is always helpful. Involve an adoption social worker at an early stage so that they understand the child's networks, and ensuring early consultation with professionals with specialist knowledge and experience of both contact and of working with birth families. The full range of contact options, including digital, should be actively considered by professionals and court in care and placement proceedings, rather than just an assumption that contact will be via letterbox only. That means an active investigation of how direct contact might work, including the expectations of adoptive carers and birth parents, and a renewed emphasis on post-adoption contact in the final care plan, and specific consideration of sibling contact. Included in that is the Children's Guardian's final analysis should address whether investigations of post-adoption contact has been broad enough. And finally, for the court, they need to exercise active consideration of Section 26 orders, which may set the tone for what is planned and what will happen after the adoption order. They must ensure that there aren't big gaps in contact and allow for a period of time for proposed contact to be actively supported by the adoption agency.
Now we whiz through Chapter 1 of the report, we'll move on extremely briefly to RE-R&C 2024. The local authority appealed against a refusal of placement order concerning a sibling group aged 6, 5, 3 and 2. The youngest two, R&C, were the subject of the appeal. Baker, Lord Justice Baker, led the judgment and emphasised that the court must consider post-adoption contact at the placement order stage, and can set the tone for future contact where this is in the child's best interest. The final outcome was an order for face-to-face contact to be made for those younger two children. So that really is a whistle-stop tour of the recent consideration of adoption by the Family Division. And we thought we'd just have a little chat between us, share with you, obviously, as to those issues that we thought to us really shone out or were worth discussing. I particularly like, Stephanie, the fact that the report widens the net of important people to a child. So all those obvious people, and they name godparents and not necessarily biological relationships, previous foster carers. I thought that was really insightful.
I agree. I think it's because in order to establish your identity, as you referred to Sir Andrew McFarlane's comments about the sense of identity of a person is much more acknowledged and important now, that also takes into consideration the fact that they don't need to be biologically related to the child in order to be significant to them.
And I think that's particularly important where there might not be face-to-face contact with a parent, but they might have a godparent or somebody who isn't actually doesn't have the status of a godparent, but is, you know, a trusted neighbour or somebody they saw or an aunt or a cousin. I mean, why does it have to be parents?
Well, it doesn't necessarily. And also those people can relay memories or information to the child that will be helpful or of comfort to them as well. So I think it's really positive that they are widening the net of important people. What do you think about the emphasis on education and understanding?
So key, so important. Yeah. I mean, I've been doing this a long time. You've been doing it not that long a time. But so often the adoption social worker would just have a policy. It would be a policy. We only do letterbox contact for adoption.
Yeah.
And they were so they were so objectionable, really. There was nothing beyond that policy. You know, you could say to them, what about the research? I mean, particularly from my trustee bit, I'd see all the research and there'd be adoption agencies lobbying the government to get that research because it's so important to give the children a firm base, a proper understanding. And it's just, it's not there. I don't think it's still there. I really don't think it's still there.
Well, perhaps following this report, more of it's going to be implemented because it needs to be a change across the entire system, doesn't it? Not only in terms of practitioners, the judiciary, social workers, but also the prospective adoptive parents need to be on board with the idea.
But don't you think the fact that that's expensive for local authorities?
Yeah.
And they just can't afford it, and they will say they can't afford it, so they'll cut that because it's a kind of hidden cost they can not take on?
Yeah, I think that is going to be problematic in terms of the support that's required, because also the report proposes, which I quite liked, or I liked a lot, was the fact that adoption needs to be, or post-adoption contact needs to be considered post-proceedings, because you often have, or I have sometimes clients that withdraw from proceedings. And I imagine that it's because of the emotional turmoil or the prospect of potentially being permanently separated from your child. And the idea that perhaps that door isn't slammed shut and is left open, I think is just something that is really wonderful.
And both ways, because the adopters go away with this idea, well, we've adopted the child and the birth parents are out of the way.
Yeah.
And I think it cuts both ways, doesn't it? If everybody keeps that door open, that mind open, that open-minded attitude and considerate at each stage.
Yeah.
And I used to go to attachment theory lectures, and it's all the same thing. It's, you know, good attachment, bad attachments, insecure attachments. If you can manage to circumnavigate that by some kind of education and what the child understands, it's got to be beneficial to everybody. Mm-hmm. It really has. I really liked the comment at paragraph 89, because of course we all know this, that 89 says, while care proceedings may focus on the failings of birth parents, prospective adopters need to be clearly shown the positives as well as the negatives. I mean, it's common sense, you know. You read a, I don't know what they're called now, whatever the form is an adopter gets to a profile of a child, and it looks as though the birth parents have been unmitigatingly rubbish and awful and appalling, and there's no positives there. Mm. So it disincentivizes them to want to have contact.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think the idea that adults might be able to have some form of communication with one another that makes them not completely alien to one another can only be better for the children, because if your primary carer has potentially a negative view of your birth parent, that can't be good. Whereas if sometimes there are positives need to be highlighted to the adoptive parents too, so they can appreciate the shortcomings of the birth parents, but also things that they did well. And often it may be that they had an extremely close bond with the child, for example. And that might be something that would be nice for the adoptive parent to learn.
Shall we discuss whether we think this is an attempt to impact on policy, change policy or not?
Yeah.
Shall we jump to that?
Because
although wonderful Andrew McFarlane's keen to emphasise this isn't a policy document, this isn't an attempt to change the law, do we think it's a policy document? Do we think it's a very clever pincer manoeuvre between Baker LJ, McFarlane and Frances Judd to force the hand of the government to do something that's long overdue?
Well, I know that it's stated explicitly that it isn't, but I would hope that it would be, because it can only then buttress the movement that needs to happen in terms of the sea change, as it were, within the adoption process and post-adoption contact, which I think is really encouraging and positive, and as you say, long overdue.
Maybe it's the groundswell which will help. I mean, we know that report cites some of the House of Lords Children and Families Committee when they're saying a letterbox contact's really outdated, but then there's that failure to do very much about it. So perhaps it's more than the pincer. I don't know, is pincer more than four people? Can you have more than four groups pincering? I'm not sure.
I don't know.
Anyway, I think if it's a group impact.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think it's very cleverly done, if that's the motivation behind it, which I imagine it is.
It's very clever. It's very welcome.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we're going to stop right there, unless Stephanie tells me otherwise.
No, I think we are going to stop right there, but not before we mention
a couple of things.
Yes.
First of all, I'm going to mention that the FLBA I saw are having this kind of discussion with Mrs. Justice Judd next Tuesday, the 10th of December, but it will be online if you hear this afterwards. And Kate Hughes is also doing that with her. And there's a 42BR Barristers webinar on the 6th of March next year, and it's on R&C, Adoption and Fostering, which is partly why we didn't cover that quite so much detail.
Yeah.
And Sharon and Charmaine Club are doing that. So do sign up for that. There'll be a list out somewhere.
And thank you very much for tuning in to 42 Talks. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. To listen to other episodes, follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever else you get your podcasts.